You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Elizabeth. I'll be reading with Mary. We'll be reading from the Eagle Tribune, excuse me, and the Lowell Sun, dated Tuesday, April 7th, 2026. We would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Mary, would you like to start us off this morning?
Sure. Good morning. Thank you, Elizabeth. This is an article written by Melanie Gilbert. Is project within scope of current $418 million budget. Lowell, city taxpayers finally may be able to breathe a sign of relief regarding the cost overruns on the Lowell High School rebuild and renovation project. The $418 million project was designed by the architect firm of Perkins Eastman. It's being built by Suffolk Construction and overseen by Sanska, the owner project manager who represents the city's interest. It is currently $36 million over budget due to the unforeseen construction issues with the Phase 3 portion of the project. Suffolk Construction Senior Project Manager Kyle Regis told members of the school building committee during the April 2nd meeting that the faulty steel beams discovered in the 1892 Coburn Hall will be removed and will not need to be replaced. Nothing will be repaired, replaced, or remediated, Regis said. It's actually now a full demolition and removal. The estimated cost for the structural remediation work of Coburn Hall will be $350,000. The report will be presented to the Lowell City Council Tuesday night. During the school building committee, February 26, Sanka Project Director Kevin Kane shed some light on the structural issues from the construction work done in the 1900s. Kane said the issue was discovered January 15th after the Phase 4 demolition Coburn Hall. Steel channels were attached to the sides of the timbers, and those channels needed to be attached to the foundation to provide additional support, Kane said. That is the work that wasn't done. There was no explanation on how those structural renovations that did not align with the structural details of the 1990 renovation project were approved and passed inspection. The structural steel was for a mezzanine level, which previously held teacher and faculty offices. Perkins Eastman and Suffolk Construction conducted site visits and issued field bulletins in which contractors review the site and make proposals throughout February to review the scope of the work needed to correct it. The project team came up with a construction workaround. Instead of connecting the steel beams to the adjoining columns, which could have been a costly and time-consuming repair, the team will instead remove them and open up that space. They are going to be removed in short order, Regis said. It will be a double-height space to the ceiling. The four-phase high school project broke ground in 2020 with the demolition of the old dentist office at Arcan Drive. That site became the phase one construction of the new Riddick Athletic Center, which opened up in 2022. Phases 1 and 2 considered of new construction and are complete, including the five-story Fresh Academy and the three-story addition that connects the academy, the gym, and the new school entrance, the Father Morissette Boulevard entrance. Phases 3 and 4 were more complicated renovation projects of the now-open 1980s building and the 1992 and 1892 buildings. Regis said the Cyrus Irish Auditorium and the North Bridge are both open. The Phase 4 turnover is suspected to take place in 2027, almost 1 year behind schedule, and $36 million over budget. The Overtomb is the result of structural issues with the renovation of the basement slab in the 1922 building that in turn delayed the project timeline by an entire year from the summer of 2026 to the fall of 2027. Built, and that figure is $2 million in slab repairs to the 1892 building, which has its own basement floor issues that were discovered months after those in the 1922 building. The answer to committee concerns about additional expensive construction issues, Kane said, the entirety of the 1892 building was now visible to the project team. Right now, almost the entire building is demolished and is visible to us. He said, we can see everything that we need to see, and we're feeling a little bit more comfortable. The committee unanimously supported the $36 million loan order that was approved by the City Council in January. The funding of this added structural remediation scope will be from within the current budget for the project. Scansert memo said, the committee next meets May 14, and a walkthrough of the site of the school building committee and City Hall members takes place on May 16 at 10 a.m. Assistant City Manager Sean Machado said monthly walkthroughs will be scheduled through the end of the project. Over to you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Mary. Over to the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. Mayor launches independent probe. This is by Jill Harmansinski Lawrence. As he was with previous controversy, Mayor Brian DePena is commissioning an independent investigation after clandestine taping that occurred at City Hall. The independent investigation was launched Thursday, April 2nd, DePena said in a statement released Friday evening. Information on who was hired to do the investigation, how much they are being paid, and the scope of services involved, however, was unavailable from City Hall on Monday. Early last week, video and audio tape from City Hall was leaked where Castro, DePena's former chief of staff, and Francisco Urena, Lawrence Airport director, could be seen and heard talking outside the mayor's office. Since then, Castro has been terminated and calls for DePena to resign amid the taping investigation have been heard. An immediate call for DePena's resignation came from the New England Police Benevolent Association, a union that represents police officers. City Council President Giovanni Rodriguez also said Pena should consider stepping down if the secret recordings took place in his office and he was aware of it. He described the leak of video as espionage situation that was politically motivated. DePena on Friday did not directly address calls for his resignation. City councilors are scheduled to meet Tuesday night and are expected to endorse an order calling for a criminal investigation into the video recordings. DePena hired two consultants to conduct investigations and issue reports after Castro, who was the former acting Lawrence police chief, was stripped of his policing credentials after he was involved in a high-speed chase. The first report compiled by Comprehensive Investigations Consulting recommendations Castro's termination for falsifying a police report and lying about it among transgressions. The second report by Maverick and Lowell-based RCB Associates, LLC, was commissioned to determine whether collusion among specific parties compromised the integrity of the investigation conducted by Daniel Bennett of Comprehensive Investigations and Consultings. Maverick and RCB wrote that they found no definitive evidence of collusion involving Michael Owens, former City Hall Human Resources Director, Daniel Bennett from CIC, or members of the Lawrence Police Department's Superior Officers Union. Allegations of personal connections or biases influencing the investigation were unsubstantiated, the report indicates. Back to you, Mary.
Thank you, Elizabeth. 18-year-old woman is assaulted at the Blue Shamrock. Second criminal complaint at the Lowell Pub in March 2026. For the second time in 1 month with criminal violations, the latest incident involved an underage patron who alleged served alcohol and assaulted at the Market Street Pub. The alleged incident took place the same night as a previously reported incident in which an employee was charged with criminal conduct by the Lowell Police Department for an alleged violent assault on three patrons that resulted in fractured ribs, broken bones, chipped teeth, and lacerations, which required emergency transport. Both incidents took place during the city's bicentennial kickoff celebration. All the victims independently reported the alleged assaults to Lowell Police Department. None of the assaults were reported by the bar staff or management as required by the city's ordinance. Joshua Usham, 19, of Reagan, was arrested March 1st and charged with the assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, a glass bottle, and on the unnamed 18-year-old female victim. In a March 24 memorandum to Licensed Commission Chair Joseph Donahue, Lowell Police Superintendent Greg Houdon requested enforcement action to be taken against Nick Petrakos, the owner and licensed manager of the Blue Shamrock, for that and other CRAIL violations of the Lowell License Commission's rules and regulations. According to Houdon's narrative presented during the Commission April 2nd meeting at the City Hall, a Lowell police officer responded to the Lowell General Hospital emergency room during the early morning hours of March 1st for what was reported to be an assault. Upon his arrival in the ER, he was led into a treatment room and immediately observed a young female with significant swelling and blue and purple bruising on her left cheek, Houdon said. She also had two lacerations that were actively bleeding, one on the bridge of her nose and another on her cheek, just under her left eye. The alleged victim and her friends were at the Blue Shamrock earlier that night when she encountered a man known to her, according to the report. She and this male, identified as Jassam, engaged in a heated verbal argument, and at some point, this male began to chase the female in the bar, Houdon said. To escape Jussam's alleged aggressive behavior, The woman ran to the side of the bar to seek refuge. Yusam caught up to the woman and allegedly threw a glass bottle at her face, which she said was witnessed by the Blue Shamrock bartender. This assault happened in full view of the patrons and staff of the Blue Shamrock. The female was attended to by her friends and left the bar to seek medical treatment. Hudon said, at no time did any staff member offer to contact the police or offer medical aid. In this memorandum, Hudon told the licensed commission that indifference to the victim's injuries by the staff of the Blue Shamrock was inexcusable and a clear violation of Section 116 of the Lowell Licensed Commission rules and regulations, which require a manager or licensee to assist any person injured in the establishment. The alleged victim confirmed to the Lowell Police Department that despite being only 18 years old, she had been served alcohol by a bartender who she described as a pregnant female with short black hair. Petrakos could not be reached for comment Monday, but he has previously defended the operation and management of the 30-plus years establishment, despite a lengthy record of appearances before the License Commission on a variety of violations, including a one-day suspension for an incident in which police said an underage UMass Lowell student appeared to have her drink spiked on the premises. The bar served a suspension for issues related to the incident last November. Hudon said that the effects of the altered drink was consistent with the effects of rohypnol, a drug known to be used to facilitate sexual assaults. Petrakos also came before the commission in September 2024 for allegedly overstepping fake IDs. The commission placed that violation on file with the condition that no further violations occurred at the bar. Thanks to a quirk in the city's ordinance, there are no bars in Lowell. Establishment that serve food and restaurants with age limits do not apply, although providing alcohol to underage patrons is a criminal offense and a violation to establish state laws. As the Blue Shamrock is classified as a restaurant with an alcohol license, it is not unlawful for it to admit patrons under 21 years of age, provided that they are only served food and not alcohol. Before owning the Blue Shamrock, Petrakos was the chief of staff to former state senator Stephen Panakakos and the venue hosts numerous political committee events. Licensees are required to keep an employee log that is an accurate list of the names of all employees, including names, addresses, date of birth, date of hire, and position they're working. Hudon said that the employee log for the latest March 1 assault was not provided to Sergeant Tracy Kelly of the Lowell Police Criminal Investigation Bureau. Instead of being provided with this required information, Sergeant Kelly was instead provided with a handwritten list of names containing first name only, without any additional information that would allow for the positive identification of the female bartender who witnessed the assault and also illegally served her alcohol. Hudon said, the Sun asked License Commission Executive Secretary John Pyre for a copy of the Blue Shamrock employee log, which he declined to provide due to privacy concerns. They are redacted to hide individuals' employment status and hours of work, which is not public record and infringes on their safety, Paya said by email on March 31st. Additional documents like full week schedules with people's full names and job titles are not public record and are not included. Houdon requested the commission schedule a compliance hearing for allegations of misconduct on both March 1st and incidents. The licensed commissioner unanimously voted to schedule Blue Shamrock's hearing for May 7th. Over to you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Mary. Voters to decide on amended ballot veil bylaw. This is by Angelina Barabee of Andover. Voters will decide on amending the Ballotville Historic District's bylaw during the town meeting beginning April 28th. The amended bylaw to be voted on at town meeting would streamline the original's 12 sections to 8 in an effort to reduce redundancies. It also shifts the focus to framing the historic district as a live-in neighborhood with more flexibility and promotes collaborative accommodation between homeowners and the Ballotville Historic District Commission. The commission held its last public forum on the bylaw changes April 1st, when residents were presented with an opportunity to provide feedback on the proposed amended bylaw. The forum was attended by a couple of dozen residents, assisted planning director Lisa Schwartz said. The planning board, select board, and preservation commission previously approved recommending the warrant article at recent meetings. The proposed amended bylaw comes after residents at the town, at the 2025 town meeting sought to have the historic district's general bylaw repealed. As petitioners said, the Ballotville Historic District Commission imposed unnecessary burdens on the homeowners in the neighborhood. The private warrant was shot down, but it sparked a debate and led to the Ballotville Historic District Commission revisiting the bylaw after 30 years since it was established. The bylaw requested by the commission was originally enacted following concern from residents over proposed demolition of some historic structures. The goal is to make the bylaw easier to digest while also considering exempting additional items as allowed by Massachusetts General Law, Commissioner Catherine Robinson told the Select Board March 16th. The Ballotville Historic District covers Central Ballotville, a 19th century planned mill village with Sauchene River. Andover Street serves as one of the main streets to establish the district's boundaries and includes portions of adjacent streets like Highvale Lane, Tewksbury, Chester, and Oak Streets, and Clark Road. Central Ballotville also consists of Maryland, Dale, and High Streets. Homes in that area vary in age, some dating back to the late 1700s and others to the 1900s. The updated bylaw includes language about working toward a collaborative relationship with residents to understand their needs to make reasonable improvements consistent with preservation to the district's historic village character. It's about reasonable accommodations, being pragmatic, balancing historic preservation, but also understanding the needs of property owners, Town Clerk Austin Simcoe said at the Select Board meeting. There is also expedited approval when applicants make requested modifications, so residents don't have to wait as long as the commission to meet. Excuse me, he added. A change to the bylaw would address the scope of the commission's powers. In 1995 bylaw, the commission was allowed to impose dimensional and setback requirements beyond zoning in some cases. The updated bylaw does not allow the commission to go beyond zoning and seeks to reduce its discretionary power. A major change would be the exemption of roof-mounted solar panels. They would no longer need to be reviewed by the commission. Excuse me. Retaining walls under 4 feet and satellite dishes are also listed as an exemption for review. All current exemptions in the bylaws, the storm doors and windows, paint and roofing, colors and materials, have been retained in the proposed bylaw. The historic district's design guidelines, which can have additional exemptions that can't be in the bylaw, like chimneys, do not need to be voted on at town meeting. The commission is actively working on these with a consultant and reviewing templates to find the best one for Andover. Back to you, Mary.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Mass addressing BART advocate shortage with incentive plan. Some courts in Massachusetts are still operating without any defense attorneys present to take on the backlog of cases of indigent defendants, a crisis that is being addressed by temporary pay incentive programs. There continues to be a shortage of available defense counsel, and as this court stated in its order, the shortage of available defense counsel is caused in large part by inadequate compensation rates. The Committee for Public Counsel Service reported to the Supreme Judicial Court, the state's highest court, in March 25 filing. An incentive program run by the CPCS entitles attorneys in good standing with any bar advocate program to a one-time $500 payment for each additional case they take on in Suffolk and Middlesex counties through June 30th, or until there is no longer any defendants in these courts awaiting counsel, whichever comes first. The fact that they are currently offering disincentive pay suggests that we are not out of this crisis, and the legislature will have to continue to address these issues. Shira Diner, a clinical lecturer in law at Boston University who has been involved in BART advocacy, told the Herald. The incentive structure is based on multiples of 5 cases from the criminal trial. Support units on assigned defendants list, where to BART advocates can take on 5, 10, or 15 such cases for a possible maximum of $7,500 incentive bonuses. 15 cases at $500 each. BART advocates are private lawyers who can take on the cases of indigent defendants on a contract basis. A recent filing by the CPCS to the Supreme Judicial Court, the state's highest court, said that as March 25th, there were no Boston Municipal Court defendants on their list as not having counsel, but that hasn't been the usual case. Between February 20th and March 2024, the BMC reported 44 unprecedented defendants, with the majority being in the Roxbury, Central, and South Boston divisions. Middlesex District Courts reported 59 unprecedented defendants, with most being those at Cambridge District Court. The agency also reported that its own lawyers, who are staff attorneys who represent indigent defendants, who split the total load with bar advocates in both counties, continue to be near capacity. As of March 25th, filing 185 eligible attorneys had applied to the incentive program requesting 2,475 cases. alone history. Pay for bar advocates became a serious statewide issue by the end of May 2025. In early July of that year, the SJC initiated what is known as the LaValle Protocol as a means of disposing a backlog of indigent criminal cases due to a work stoppage, a kind of a strike by bar advocates. This protocol set time limits for how long criminal defendants could be held without legal representation and allowed cases to be dropped if a defendant went too long without legal representation, which they are constitutionally entitled to. But even the significant pressure of hundreds, then thousands of criminal defendants being released or their cases dropped did little to move the needle on a permanent solution to the problem. As the work stoppage dragged on, bar advocates and state legislature continued to point fingers at one another. State Senator Lydia Edwards, a Boston Democratic and co-chair of the Judiciary Committee, told the Herald in July 2025 that I would love to see is them get back to work in good faith and commitment from us in good faith to work on an increase in their wages. Last August, the state legislature passed and Governor Maura Healey signed a bill into law that raised district court level bar advocate pay by $10 per hour from $65 to $75, and that would give an additional $10 per hour raise to $85 later. John Delaney, an attorney who has served as a leader of the movement for bar advocate pay increases, called the raise a slap in the face that ignored the financial pressures bar advocates face, which includes law school debt and paying for their own benefits out of pocket. The CPCS appealed to the Supreme Judicial Court to solve the issue, but the court declined to take the action and said that the issue is in the hands of the legislature. The SJC wrote in its decision that CPCS failed to prove the existence of extraordinary circumstances that would justify the judicial intervention it seeks. Over to you, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Mary. SJC to Wade DiSoglio's audit lawsuit. This is by Christian Wade, State House Reporter, Boston. The state's highest court will hear arguments next month in a legal fight stemming from the state auditor Diane DiSoglio's push to force legislative leaders to comply with the voter-approved audit. The Supreme Judicial Court has scheduled oral arguments for May 6th in Attorney General Andrea Campbell's motion to dismiss DiSoglio's lawsuit against House Speaker Ron Mariano and Senate President Karen Spilka that asked the court to order them to open up their books for audit. DiSoglio, a Methuen Democrat and former state lawmaker, has clashed for more than a year with legislative leaders over implementation of Question 1, which authorized her office to conduct a performance and financial audit of the legislature to ensure that it is following government rules and regulations. The referendum was approved in 2024 election by nearly 72% of voters, according to the official results. Lawyers for Mariano and Spilka have continued to push back against voter-approved law, repeating claims that the audit would violate separation of powers doctrine. They note that the House and the Senate already conduct regular audits of their financial operations. In a motion to dismiss the case, Campbell said DiSoglio filed the lawsuit without authorization from the Attorney General and by an attorney not designated to act as a special assistant attorney general. Campbell said the AG's office is the gatekeeper empowered to determine when, if ever, the Commonwealth's intergovernmental legal disputes require judicial resolution. Last month, Delilah Wendlandt rejected DiSoglio's request to appoint a special assistant attorney general to represent her office in the lawsuit to force legislative leaders to comply with the audit, with Campbell opting to represent legislative leaders in the court fight. DiSoglio has accused Campbell of creating a conflict of interest for herself by choosing to represent legislative leaders against her office in court. Backers of the audit have filed briefs to the Supreme Judicial Court ahead of the oral arguments, urging justices to reject Campbell's motion to dismiss the lawsuit. The Attorney General's motion to strike improperly elevates executive control over an independent constitutional officer, effectively nullifying both statutory authority and a decisive electoral mandate in which approximately 72% of Massachusetts voters approve legislative audits. State Representative Sylvia, a Fall River Democrat, wrote in the legal filing. DiSoglio is urging others to file so-called friend of the court briefs to the SJC in support of her efforts ahead of next month's oral arguments, which she said could have a very strong impact on the court's decision. Last week, DiSoglio asked Democratic Governor Mara Healey, who has largely stayed out of the audit fight, to file a brief to the SJC in support of her legal challenge. The governor keeps saying she supports the legislative audit, but public comments with no action won't help increase the public trust on the issue. DiSoglio said in a statement Monday, this is her opportunity to get on the record in court where it counts, support due process, civil rights, and the will of the people. The auditor's lawsuit is the latest legal challenge over the outcome of question one, which authorized her office to conduct an audit of the state legislature. Lawyers for Mariano and Spilka have continued to push against the voter-approved law, repeating claims that the audit would violate separation of powers doctrine. Several Republicans, including former state lawmakers and GOP chairman Jim Lyons, have also filed lawsuits asking the courts to force legislative leaders to comply with the referendum. Back over to you, Mary.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Narrative on UFOs and ETs reaches back many decades. Before zombies shambled about, ghoulishly feasting on the flesh of those too slow to flee, aliens from outer space ruled movie theaters, drive-ins, and late Saturday night creature features on television. Even as Hollywood still drives how Americans envisions little green men with big eyes and bigger heads, fiction soon could be separated from or revealed as fact if government agencies release secret files related to extraterrestrials and UFOs as called for in February by President Donald Trump. The science fiction genre has shaped how people think about intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. Whether it's invasion narrative or aliens coming to warn us that we are on the wrong track, or aliens just trying to come and make contact with us, with things, or just say hi, says Duke University professor Priscilla Wald, who teaches a class on science fiction and film. Trump announcement on social media followed former President Barack Obama suggesting in a podcast interview that aliens were real. Obama later clarified that he had not seen evidence that aliens had made contact, but said since the universe is so vast, at odds are good that life exists elsewhere. Movies say they are nearly everywhere, from Pennsylvania cornfields in 2002, signs to Wyoming's Devil Tower in 1977, Close Encounters of the Third Kind to a Central American jungle where 1987 Predator was set. Hollywood has basically been preparing the public for this, retired Navy Rear Admiral Timothy Gallette says, of any revelation that intelligent life from outer space exists and has visited Earth. I think people can handle it. It does, of course, depend on what information is released by the government. Hollywood quickly latched on following the 1947 discovery of debris near Roswell, New Mexico. Authorities initially identified crash materials as flying discs before quickly backtracking and saying they were from a high-altitude weather balloon. About 3 years after Roswell, the flying saucer made it to theaters. That was followed by some low-budget and mostly forgettable movies, while others continued to inspire sci-fi buffs like the 1951's The Day the Earth Stood Still. If you still think back to the flourishing of alien films, this starts really in the U.S. in the 1950s, Wall says. The aliens are gentle souls who come down and try to warn us after nuclear war. She says of the Earth Stood Still. They're trying to warn that we are creating problems in the cosmos and that if we don't drop, they are and have to do something about it. Still, others depict visitors arriving with more nefarious motives and intentions to kill us, to take over the earth, sometimes even to make us food. I think if we found out aliens were on the way, there would be a mix of responses, Wallace said. I think there would be a lot of people out there welcoming them. A lot of people would be going down to cellars and stocking them with canned food. A plethora of documentaries also have been released, including 2025's The Age of Disclosure, which details government knowledge of existence of intelligent life outside of humans and attempts to reverse engineer alien technology. Over to you, Elizabeth. That's interesting.
Thank you, Mary. A proposed new fix for Social Security that harms workers and protects the rich. This is on Their View by Michael Hiltzik. How worried are Americans wealthy about the possibility they'll be hit with a higher tax for Social Security? Plenty, judging from the endless creativity of their proposals to improve programs' fiscal condition by cutting benefits rather than by raising revenue, typically from the most affluent taxpayers. The latest run at this fence comes from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which, as I've explained before, is an offspring of late billionaire hedge fund operator Peter G. Peterson, who was an obdurant foe of Social Security. The committee dubs its proposal the six-figure limit, which is accurate enough. It could cap annual Social Security benefits at $50,000 per person or $100,000 per couple. Make no mistake, this is a benefit cut. The proponents say it will affect only the richest, but true only as a snapshot of current conditions. Only about 1.2 million of the 53.6 million retirees receiving benefits today, or about 2.3%, receive enough to reach the $50,000 annual cap. Typically, they are retirees who earned maximum taxable wages income $184,500 this year, almost every year of their working careers, and also opted to defer receiving their benefits until age 70 to receive a higher monthly stipend. Thanks mostly to inflation, however, the cap will creep into middle class as sure as water seeks its own level. That may take years, but by the time today's youngest workers retire, it would be entrenched in the system. The proposal reflects one of Pete Peterson's hobby horses, which was the idea that scads of money could be saved by means testing Social Security so billionaires like himself don't get handouts they don't need. The six-figure limit reads like the stepchild of that notion, but as I've reported before, the problem with it is means testing Social Security wouldn't save the program much money unless you started cutting means tested benefits as incomes as small as $50,000. The CRFB proposal, as embodied in the exemplary manifesto posted on its website, doesn't explain why $100,000 should be cut off, other than that maybe it's a nice round number. This is a program that, when you go back to the founding, was the measure of protection against falling into poverty, Mark Goldwyn, the committee's senior policy director, told CBS News. The fact that an income support program would pay six figures is a little silly. I asked the committee what's silly about a couple receiving $100,000 from Social Security after they've paid for all their lives, and given the U.S. median household income was $1,071 when Social Security was founded in 1935, and today's is $83,730, I didn't hear back. The committee acknowledges that only a small fraction of retirees currently receive benefits of $50,000 or more, but it frets that $100,000 benefit will become increasingly common as Social Security benefits formula leads benefits to grow over time. This isn't quite true. It's an economic growth more than a benefit formula that does that by advancing average wages. Social Security advocates and experts have responded to the proposal with disdain. Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works, labels it a Trojan horse. That's because of its proposed structure. The committee presents three possible models. Two would fix the cutoff at $50,000 per person for 20 or 30 years. The third would allow it to increase its in accordance with the chained consumer price index. A little used information metric that rises more slowly than the commonly used urban CPI. Excuse me. Either way, Altman observes the $100,000 amount will continue to erode to the point that its substance level benefit unrelated to prior to earnings, such just as conservatives have been advocating since 1936. The CRFB manifesto is a scary document. It asserts the cap would be a boon for economic growth by reducing federal borrowing and prompting retirees to rely more on resources such as personal savings and investment returns. This happens according to a large body of research finding that workers, specifically high income, increase their private retirement savings in response to reductions in expected public benefits. In other words, if you're afraid your Social Security is going to be cut, you put more in your IRA. That makes sense, but only superficially. First, What about everyone other than high-income workers? Many middle- and working-class households already struggle to meet common everyday expenses, let alone saving for college and retirement. Where will they find the money they'll need once Social Security is gutted? Second, who says workers invariably save more when they're afraid of Social Security cuts? The committee footnotes that assertion to a Congressional Budget Office meta-analysis of 30 studies conducted in 1998. What did the CBO learn? It was that no one knows. Some studies, the CBO said, found that each dollar of expected Social Security reduces personal savings, but the range of reduction was between 0 and 50 cents. In other words, the phenomenon may or may not be real, and if not, this pillar of six-figure limit crumbles into the dust. People will be thrown back on personal resources that don't exist. The CRFB manifesto contains other specious arguments. For example, it argues that American Social Security benefits are unduly generous in global terms. It validates this conclusion by comparing the maximum benefit in the U.S. in 2024, $93,452 for a couple, to those of such advanced economies as France, $69,403 in purchasing parity with the U.S., Canada, $43,608, and the Netherlands, $41,765. Yet the comparisons are suspect. National pension systems are highly diverse. France's Social Security program, for example, is a mandatory supplement to private pensions, unlike in the United States. In some countries, old age benefits are part of a broad social programs that include universal government paid health care, as well as the government child care and other social services that don't exist in the U.S. I asked the CRFB to respond to these issues, but received no reply. It's important to keep in mind that proposals like this one have fundamental goal, sparing the wealthy from an increase in Social Security payroll tax, which is the only way to ensure the program's fiscal feet stand on the ground other than cutting benefits. This year, the tax of 12.4% is levied on wage earners up to $184,500, with half paid out of worker paychecks and the other half directly by employers. That means workers will pay a maximum of $11,439, with employers paying the same. On wages higher than the income tax, the rate drops to zero. For someone with income of, say, $500,000, the effective rate for each side falls from 6.2% to 4.3% for those with $1 million incomes. It falls to 2.28 on each side. Since the tax rate is on wage income alone, wealthier taxpayers get an additional break. Having the income of the more of the richest Americans is in the form of investment income, which isn't taxed at all for Social Security. Making such so-called unearned income part of their tax base and eliminating the tax cap would improve Social Security's fiscal balance for more than six-figure limit, but would significantly increase that Social Security tax liability of millionaires and near millionaires. That may explain why the cat's paw in Congress and at conservative think tanks expend so much energy finding alternatives to a tax hike. In attempting to relegate this latest idea to the pile of transparent maneuvers to avert a higher Social Security tax, but the danger is that policymakers and pundits will parrot the argument that $100,000 is too much for a retirement pension. The Washington Post editorial board started the process on March 24th when an unsigned editorial headlined, "Nobody needs over $100,000 per year in Social Security benefits." The piece balanced the punitive generosity of Social Security against federal government $39 trillion in debt and the federal deficit larger than the Great Depression, as though those are consequences of providing 53 million retirees, disabled persons, and their dependents, rather than enormous tax cuts provided for the wealthy. The Post owner, Amazon.com, founder Jim Bezos, is one of the richest men on earth. Anyway, the Post's greed elicited a well-deserved beatdown from Max Rickman, president of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, who crisply informed the board that its editorial was based on the fallacy that Social Security is a welfare program. It is, in fact, social insurance. As he explained, workers pay into the program and receive payment to replace income upon retirement, disability, or the death of a family breadwinner. These are the hazardous and vicissitudes of life that President Franklin D. Roosevelt returned to when signing the Social Security law. Rickman is right about Social Security, and the CFRB is wrong. For the beneficiaries who have been saved from poverty in their own age or after disability, the difference is more than rhetorical. It's a fact of life. Michael Hiltzak is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And we're at the midpoint of our program. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. We will be back shortly to continue the reading of this morning's papers. Please stay tuned, and thank you for listening.
And we are back. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. We are back on the air with Mary reading from the Lowell Sun, and this is Christina reading from the Eagle Tribune. Starting with the Eagle Tribune from the Associated Press, Zelensky, long Mideast war could take away from support for Ukraine. Istanbul. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky expressed concern that a prolonged Israeli war on Iran could further erode America's support for Ukraine as Washington's global priorities shift and Kyiv's brace for reduced deliveries of critically needed Patriot air defense missiles. Ukraine desperately needs more U.S.-made Patriot air defense systems to help it counter Russia's daily brigades, Zelensky said, speaking to the Associated Press in an exclusive interview late Saturday in Istanbul. Russia's relentless pounding of urban areas behind the front line following its full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than 4 years ago has killed thousands of civilians. It has also targeted Ukraine's energy supply to disrupt industrial production of Ukraine's newly developed drones and missiles, while also denying civilians heat and running water in winter. We have to recognize that we are not the priority for today, Zelensky said. That's why I am afraid of long Iran war will give us less support. The latest U.S. brokered talks between envoys from Moscow and Kyiv ended in February with no sign of breakthrough. Zelensky, who has accused Russia of trying to drag out negotiation while it presses on with its invasion, said Ukraine remains in contact with U.S. negotiators about a potential deal to end the war and has continued to press for stronger security guarantees. But, he said, even those discussions reflect a broader loss of focus from Ukraine. His most immediate concern, Zelensky said, are the Patriots, essential for intercepting Russian ballistic missiles, as Ukraine still lacks an effective alternative. The U.S. systems were never delivered in sufficient quantities to begin with, Zelensky said. And if the Iran war doesn't end soon, The package, which is not very big for us, I think will be smaller and smaller day by day. That's why, of course, we are afraid, he said. Interlinked wars. Zelensky had been counting on European partners to help make the Patriot purchases despite tight supply and limited U.S. production capacity. But the Iran war, now in its sixth week, has sent shockwaves through the global economy and pulled in much of the wider Middle East region, further straining these already limited resources, diverting stockpiles, and leaving Ukraine cities more exposed to ballistic strikes. A key objective is to weaken Moscow's economy and make the war prohibitively costly. Surging oil prices driven by Iran's closure of the Strait of Hormuz are undermining the strategy by boosting the Kremlin's oil revenues and strengthening Moscow's capacity to sustain its war effort. In his interview with the AP, Zelensky said Russia draws economic benefits from the Mideast war, citing that limited easing of American sanctions on Russian oil. Russia gets additional money because of this, so yes, they have benefits, he said. Russian officials said Sunday a fire broke out at a major oil refinery in the Nizhny Novgorod region after a drone attack, while other drone damaged a pipeline at the Russian Baltic Sea port of Primorsk, home to a major oil export terminal. No casualties were reported. Russia could reap a windfall from a surge in oil prices and the U.S. temporary waiver on Russian oil sanctions designed to ease supply shortages as the Iran war continues. Russia is one of the world's main oil exporters, and Asian nations are increasingly competing for Russian crude oil as an energy crisis mounts. In response, Ukraine has intensified its long-range drone attacks on Russian oil facilities, which have rattled Moscow. To keep Ukraine on the international agenda, Zelensky has offered to share Ukraine's hard-earned battlefield expertise with the United States and allies to develop effective countermeasures against Iranian attacks. Ukraine has met Russia's evolving use of Iranian-made Shahed drones with growing sophistication, technological ingenuity, and low cost. Moscow significantly modified the original Shahed 136, rebranded as the Garand 2, enhancing its ability to evade air defenses and be mass-produced. Ukraine responded with quick innovations of its own, including low-cost interceptor drones designed to track and destroy incoming drones. Zelensky said Ukraine is ready to share with Gulf Arab countries targeted by Iran its experience and technology, including interceptor drones and sea drones, which Ukraine produces more than are used up with funding from Americans and its European partners. In return, these countries could help Ukraine with anti-ballistic missiles, Zelensky said. In late March, as the Iran war escalated, Zelensky visited Gulf Arab states to promote Ukraine's singular experience in countering Iranian-made Shahed drones, leading to new defense cooperation agreements. Zelensky has also positioned Ukraine as a potential partner in safeguarding global trade routes, offering assistance in reopening the Strait of Hormuz by sharing Ukraine's experiences securing maritime corridors in the Black Sea. Zelensky was in Istanbul for talks with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan a day after the Turkish leader spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Zelensky said they discussed peace talks and a possible meeting of leaders in Istanbul. He also said there could be new defense deals signed between the two countries soon. Following the talks in Istanbul, Zelensky and Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan arrived in Syria on an official visit Sunday, Syrian state news agency CANA reported. Writing on X, Zelensky said he discussed the wars in the Middle East and Ukraine with Syrian President Ahmad al-Bashir, and that there is strong interest in exchanging military and security experience between Ukraine and Syria. Each year, as the weather improves, Russia moves its grinding war of attrition up a notch. However, it has been unable to capture Ukrainian cities and has made only incremental gains across rural areas. Russia occupies about 20% of Ukraine, including the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia seized in 2014. Over to you, Mary.
Thank you, Christina. A valuable police resource for the region. This article was written by Rick Posniak. When people are in crisis and need help, they call the police. When the police need help, they call the Northeast Regional Law Enforcement Council, an elite regional emergency response team serving Lowell, Fitchburg, and other communities in Middlesex and Essex communities. NEMLEC is a consortium of police and sheriff departments in the region who are called when situations escalate beyond the resources of a local police department. When a suspect is heavily armed, an active shooter in a school or shopping mall, a person barricaded in a crisis, fugitives on the run, or a child or senior citizen missing, the margin for error disappears. NEMLEC teams, including highly trained SWAT teams, units respond not as a show of force for the TV camera, but as a highly trained, disciplined, and a specialized resource built to manage risk, protect lives, and bring order to chaos. The core of the elite teams are men and women officers carefully selected from regional police and sheriff departments, as much for their judgment as for their tactical expertise. They train extensively in crisis negotiations, tactical operations. Their mission is not simply to resolve incidents, but to resolve them with the least amount of force necessary. That distinction is critical. In volatile, highly charged emotional situations, the wrong move can have irreversible consequences. NEMLEC's model extends well beyond traditional SWAP capabilities. These teams often integrate their canine units for tracking suspect or missing persons, drone technology to provide real-time aerial intelligence, and bike and motorcycle officers who can maneuver quickly through dense urban and wood environments or large-scale events. These specialized teams were activated in the search for a missing 4-year-old boy whose body was recovered from the Merrimack River in Tewksbury. They also assisted the Chelmsford and Billerica police in locating a missing person experiences a mental health crisis. Each component of NEMLEC is carefully coordinated and adds speed, visibility, and flexibility, allowing local police to make informed decisions while reducing unnecessary risk to both officers and the public. The group also provides support to keep first responders cope with the psychological impact of stressful events in a city school to better prepare for emergencies and safe learning environments. One of the most vital roles on LEMCAC plays is a local police chief asks for assistance in serving a high-risk warrant. When intelligence suggests a suspect is armed or has history of violence, sending unprepared officers increases the likely likelihood of confrontation. And EMLA brings careful planning, coordination, experience, training, and a specialized tactical equipment designed to control the situation. The goal is containment, communications, and safe resolutions, not escalation and injury. An example, Lowell Police recently requested NEMLAC SWAT assistant in executing a search warrant on a dangerous person in his Centerville apartment where drugs and firearms were seized. Equally important is the role in crisis communications and negotiations, a discipline that I have practiced and taught on the professional and college level. Barricaded subjects are often in distress and not just defiant. Whether dealing with a mental health crisis, domestic disputes, or people in desperation, train NEMLAC negotiations work tirelessly to slow situations down, build rapport, and create a safe pathway to surrender without violence or force. These efforts rarely make newspaper or TV headlines, but they are among the most effective tools for preventing tragedies. Regional teams also play a critical role in tracking down fugitives. The ability to coordinate jurisdictions combined with advanced tools, technology, and a specialized training allows them to act quickly for the best possible outcome, whether it be in a wooded area or a populated neighborhood. There is also a practical reality. Many local police departments cannot sustain this level of specialized capability on their own. NEMLACs and SWAT teams' approach allows multiple communities to share in these resources, assuring that even small communities in Middlesex or Essex counties have quick access to a top-tier response when it matters most. Public perception often focuses on the most visible aspects, armor vehicles, tactical gear, and high-intensity operations. But true measure of success is what does not happen. The shots not fired, the injured and loss of life prevented. These elite teams succeed when situations are stabilized and lives are protected with unnecessary force, unlike the undisciplined and poorly trained ICE agent caught on the news videos risking havoc on the streets of America. Communities served by NEMLA should recognize and appreciate this service, not because it is dramatic, but because it is indispensable. When the stakes are the highest, having the right police response team in place can mean the difference between chaos and resolution, and ultimately between life and death. Over to you, Christina.
Thank you, Mary. Bondi was the best attorney general we're going to get from Trump. Their View by David Mestio. It was obvious what kind of official U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi would be in the second Trump administration, about 12 years before she joined it. Long before Donald Trump came down the golden escalator. Bondi took thousands of dollars in Trump campaign donations in 2013 as Florida's attorney general and then promptly shut down an investigation of Trump University, then accused of defrauding dozens of the state's residents. Someone with the lowest possible opinion of the former Trump defense counsel wouldn't have been disappointed once she became Trump's third Senate approved attorney general. She bent and broke the law while abandoning the norm of Department of Justice independence from White House politics. Such abject obsequiousness wasn't enough for President Trump, who fired her Thursday after barely more than a year in office. When Trump wanted the Epstein files splashed across America's front pages, Bondi promptly promised to release them. When Trump changed his mind after learning of unflattering revelations about himself in the FBI documents, Bondi loyally conspired to hide Trump's role. Her Justice Department broke the law so obviously that even Republicans on the widely partisan House Judiciary Committee noticed. That wasn't the first time. Her Justice Department broke the law in deporting people despite valid and clear judicial orders not to and lied to dozens of federal judges in the process of pursuing Trump's mass deportation agenda. She and Trump violated the law in hand-picking prosecutors to file politically motivated criminal charges against a Democratic New York attorney general and a Republican former chief of the FBI. Judges promptly slapped that abuse down. In acting more as Trump's hitman than the disinterested chief law enforcement officer of the nation, no dignity was too great for her to accept. She literally took orders on her department's lawbreaking delivered by Trump's social media messaging app. Her time at the Justice Department included the purge of an FBI agents and prosecutors who had worked on the prosecution of Trump under the previous Democratic administration, which only took up the cases against the then former president after months of trying very hard to avoid it. Literally, thousands of professionals involved, along with civil rights, environmental, and other professional staffers from politically disfavored departments left. She did not act swiftly to replace them, and as a result, prosecutions by the Department of Justice plummeted. Yes, crime went down under her tenure, as Trump observed, but that was only the continuation of the trend under Joe Biden, which Trump denies ever happened. Trump was frustrated with Bondi because even as she loyally tried to cover up Trump's involvement with Epstein, facts and documents kept leaking out to the press and congregational Democrats. She was breaking the law, but not enough for Trump. Trump was also frustrated by Bondi's failure to find a workaround for the grand juries and judges who kept rejecting Trump's efforts to take revenge on his enemies from the Biden years. Again, she broke the law in making illegal appointments to carry out the prosecutions, but she wouldn't override the safeguards in the justice system. The firing of Bondi is a message to all Trump's other political appointees, Senate confirmed or not. No amount of bowing to the dear leader is enough. No shredding of your principles is enough. No amount of lawbreaking is enough. No amount of humiliation is enough to buy you the loyalty of Donald Trump. You must give him everything he wants or you'll pay the price. Trump is only loyal to himself. If there is one thing I know after a year of Trump's administration of justice, is that the next attorney general will be worse. That's what it will read on Bondi's political headstone. Here lies the career of Donald Trump's best second-term attorney general. Over to you, Mary.
Thank you, Christina. UMass Lowell tapped to offer guidance in expansion of co-op education offerings at state universities. UMass Lowell has spent years steadily growing its cooperative education options for students to get real-world experience and a job relevant to their degree. And now, University of Lowell will guide other state universities as they begin offering their own work-based learning programs. On Monday morning, with the university hosting state officials and the presidents of the three state universities around in the Massachusetts Cooperative Education Initiative to expand co-ops for higher education students. The expansion comes in the form of a pilot initiative of the State Department of Higher Education's Innovation Hub, which is awarding $20,000 each to Bridgewater State University Framingham State University and the Massachusetts College of Art, and the sign, Mass Art, for regional co-op partners set to launch in the fall of 2026 semester. In Massachusetts, a college degree should come with real experience and a direct path to a good-paying job, Governor Mara Healey said in a statement. That's why we've made historic investments on public education and set a goal of $100,000 apprentices over the next decade. And now we're launching this initiative to expand co-ops and work-based learning so more students can build skills, earn a paycheck, and graduate ready to succeed. Lieutenant Kim Driscoll was at the announcement Monday at UMass, where she said Massachusetts does transformational work in education. People come from across the Commonwealth and, frankly, across the country and across the world to come to Massachusetts schools. As a proud public higher education grad myself, these are the folks who are going to be our future leaders in business, in industry, in government, said Driscoll. She said many students in higher education are working jobs that may not be connected to what they want to do in life. Driscoll referenced a conversation she recently had with a student, where the student talked about working 30 hours a week in a job unrelated to her degree, excuse me, just to survive graduation. Imagine if we could put that kind of drive and hard work and ethics and ethos in actually having her work in a field that is connected to her degree, where those students are going to be able to go, said Driscoll. UMass already offers co-op opportunities to its students, and with that institutional experience, the university is being brought on to offer guidance to other institutions. UMass Chancellor Julie Chen said during the announcement that the challenge now is to scale these kind of programs and make them more common offerings for students. Part of the draw, Chen said, is that with these being paid co-ops by the partnering companies, higher education can be more affordable. In 6 months, they make over $20,000. That more than covers their costs with all the support of college and public higher education, said Chen. Chen repeated a promise she often makes, that all UML students are guaranteed to have the opportunity for at least one paid internship or co-op experience as they obtain their degree. Cooperative education can be transformative for college students, providing invaluable work, experience, creating connections that turn into good paying jobs after graduation, and making college education more affordable. Chen said in a statement Monday, "We are thrilled by the success of our co-op program at UMass Lowell, supported by partnerships with the Department of Higher Education or an AXIM Collaborative. We look forward to sharing the recipe for success with developing colleges across the Commonwealth so that other students would also experience the benefits of these programs." UML Celia Amelia Guatemala, who is seeking her biomedical engineering degrees, spoke about her work with Insulet as part of her co-op through UML. Insulet develops the Omnipod, a wearable disposable insulin pod. One of the things I learned from there was seeing all my classroom knowledge being applied and what was relevant and what wasn't, say Kamawala. Kamawala said she had the opportunity to be a part of a team at the company in which she has been able to give her own input, develop her communication skills, and learn a little bit about what she is and is not looking for in a career. It gave me clarity. It definitely helped me in what direction I want to take after graduation, said Cabuela. Commissioner Higher Education Noe Ortega said at the announcement that partnership between the DHE and UML will put us in a position to launch what is especially an initiative to help move the needle forward in cooperative education. We hope that with partnership in other institutions, we can really begin to move the needle on this work and truly elevate how this makes a difference in public education in our institutions, said Ortega. Education Secretary Steve Schreich touted the existing co-op programs and said hundreds of students are gaining practical and marketable skills while they are still in school. Today's announcement is about growing career-connected learning in a way that truly changes lives. I'm proud to be part of this robust experience and expansion across Massachusetts that will help our students earn, learn, and launch successful careers well before they leave their institutions or higher learning, said Psych. In a statement, Bridgewater State University President Frederick Clark said his institution is focused on creating path to employment for all the students. The co-op pilot is attracting strong interest from students and faculty and builds on the many opportunities Bridgewater provides students to explore, prepare, and connect for to career opportunity, said Clark. Framingham State University President Nancy Neamy said in a statement that work-based learning has always been part of the fabric of public higher education. At Framingham State, what is different now is that we are committed to ensuring that every student has access to a meaningful internship, co-op, or applied learning experience that complements academic journey without delaying graduation, say Neamy. This initiative reflects what was possible when higher education business and nonprofit organizations and state leadership come together with a shared purpose. MassArt President Mary Grant said in a statement that the institution is delighted that MassArt is a part of the creative thinking around this co-pilot program to expand opportunities for hands-on experience learning for our students. We plan to engage our longtime partners and establish new partnerships to complement our art and design education that prepares students for a lifetime of possibilities. Over to you, Christina.
Thank you, Mary. Subject of Raymond, New Hampshire, manhunt died by self-inflicted gunshot. Concord, New Hampshire. The Raymond, New Hampshire man who threatened family members, shot a police officer, and triggered a manhunt Saturday night died by a self-inflicted gunshot wound, authorities disclosed. An autopsy was conducted Monday on Matthew Macy, 38. The Office of the Chief Medical Examiner determined that Mr. Macy's cause of death was a single self-inflicted gunshot wound to his chin and head, and that the manner of his death was suicide, according to a statement released by Attorney General John Formella. The medical examiner also said Macy sustained a shrapnel wound to his left elbow in addition to the self-inflicted wound. The Nottingham Police Department officer who was struck in the arm and wounded by one of Massey's gunshots earlier in the day, Saturday, was released from the hospital Monday, Formella said. residents were asked to shelter in place Saturday night after Massey's confronted family members and then shot the Nottingham police officer and ran into the nearby woods. Police said he was experiencing a mental health crisis. State police said that around 1 a.m. Sunday, Massey was dead. The investigation into the officer involved use of deadly force on Massey is ongoing, and the identity of the officers who used deadly force will be disclosed once formal interviews of all involved in the incident are completed within the coming weeks, Formella said. The exact circumstances surrounding the incident remains under active investigation. All right, we are coming up to the hour. I'm just going to read, read one more thing and then we're going to close it out. For those who have young ones going to the movies, new Mario Verse film levels up the magic. There are some things you might expect, even count on, in a Super Mario Galaxy movie. The introduction of the celestial Princess Rosalina? Check. A scene of her reading bedtime stories is to her adorable glowing star children, Loomis. Check. A wild revenge scenario that takes Princess Peach, Mario, Luigi, and Toad away from the Mushroom Kingdom and into space, where intergalactical travel requires little more than a well-placed launch star that will hurtle anyone safely through cosmos and into the cozy, self-contained gravitational pulls of nearby planets. This one might depend on how familiar you are with the game itself, first released in 2007, but let's say check anyway. The Super Mario Galaxy movie has some real surprises, both coincidental and not. One of those, the introduction of Mario's Nintendo peer, Star Fox, has already been teased. But for me, the most unexpected and delightful discovery is that Bowser, voiced once more by Jack Black, and his neglected son Bowser Jr., Benny Safdie, are painters. The elder uses the brush as a kind of therapy as he works through his demons while in loose captivity, still shrunken down to the size of a toy as we left him in the Super Mario Brothers in Princess Peach's castle. The younger, so coincidentally that he's neither seen nor mentioned in the first film, paints to destroy and win his father's love for taking over the galaxy, a plan that Bowser would, on his rare night off from conquering, read to Bowser Jr. before bedtime. Absent, though he might have been for most of Bowser Jr.'s childhood, when he was there, he really went all out with puppetry and showmanship. This isn't the only family drama imbued into the Super Mario Galaxy movie. Peach, Anya Taylor-Joy, is also wondering about her origins. But thankfully, Mario, Chris Pratt, and Luigi, Charlie Day, are spared any such soul-searching. They're just along for the ride. Mario creators Shigeru Miyamoto and Illumination founder Chris Meledandri, as producers, seem committed to keeping things light and playful, even while beholden to advancing some kind of coherent, moderately compelling story where there wasn't one previously. On a certain level, everyone, including returning directors Aaron Horvitz and Michael Jelinek and screenwriter Matthew Fogel, understand that many people likely to come out to see a Super Mario movie probably aren't interested in extensive backstories, meaningful character arcs, or real-world grittiness. The joy of video games like Super Mario Galaxy is simple and pure. The viewer is transported to a colorful fantasy where space isn't scary, isn't inviting, shimmering, and full of wonder. The film adds a slew of new voice actors to the mix, like Brie Larson as Rosalina, sounding perhaps a little too much like Taylor-Joy's Peach, and Donald Glover as Yoshi, a chaotic and enjoyable addition to the gang. As in the games, he's sure to be a fan favorite. All right, and I think we're going to wrap things up so we don't run out of time. We thank you for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. You can request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio rating services, please call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can also listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. And last, visit our website where you can tune in to Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Mary and Christina, and we thank you for listening. Stay warm and enjoy the rest of your day.